From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Yo he venido a Washington para denunciar el asesinato de mi hijo en el Hotel Palestina en Bagdad el 8 de abril de 2003.
I have come to Washington to denounce the murder of my son at the Palestine Hotel during the invasion of Iraq on April 8, 2003.
A Spanish court has issued an international arrest warrant for three U.S. soldiers involved with the killing of Spanish TV cameraman Jose Coso in Iraq. We'll hear from Jose Coso's mother, as well as his brother Javier, and play an excerpt of the documentary Hotel Palestine, Killing the Witness. Then the trial of Saddam Hussein has begun in Baghdad. We'll speak with author Larry Everest.
What strikes me about all the media attention to Saddam Hussein's trial is the enormous hypocrisy of the United States. For one, it was complicit in Saddam Hussein's worst atrocities. For another, it's committing war crimes and crimes against humanity right now in Iraq.
And veteran Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk on Iraq, the media, and war.
Go to a war. You realize that it is not primarily about victory or defeat. It is about death and the infliction of death and suffering on as large a scale as you can make it. It is about the total failure of the human spirit.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Colin Powell's former chief of staff publicly accused top-level officials in the Bush administration of hijacking the country's foreign policy in ways that have undermined American democracy. The official, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, spoke Wednesday in Washington. Up until January, he was chief of staff to then-Secretary of State Colin Powell.
What I saw was a cabal between the Vice President of the United States, Richard Cheney, and the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, on critical issues that made decisions that the bureaucracy did not know were being made.
Colonel Wilkerson went on to accuse President Bush and Rumsfeld of condoning the abuse of detainees overseas.
The detainee abuse issue is just such a concrete example of what I've just described to you, that 10 years from now or so, when it's really, really put to the acid test, ironed out, and people have looked at it from every angle, we are going to be ashamed of what we've allowed to happen. I don't think in our history we've ever had a presidential involvement, a secretarial involvement, a vice presidential involvement, an attorney general involvement in telling our troops essentially carte blanche is the way you should feel. You should not have any qualms because this is a different kind of conflict.
The Financial Times described Lawrence Wilkerson's comments as the harshest attack on the administration by a former senior official since criticisms by Richard Clark and Paul O'Neill earlier the last year. Wilkerson admitted Wednesday his decision to publicly criticize the administration has led to a falling out with Colin Powell, who he's worked with for 16 years. A number of new developments have emerged in the growing scandal over the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. The New York Daily News reports President Bush admonished Karl Rove 2 years after the president reportedly learned of Rove's involvement in the leak. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports Rove told the grand jury it may have been Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, who first told him that Plame worked for the CIA. A new Pentagon study has found 28% of U.S. troops returning from Iraq have faced health problems that require medical or mental health treatment. So far this year, almost 1,700 returning soldiers harbored suicidal or self-harming thoughts. Nearly 20,000 reported nightmares. More than 3,700 said they had fears they might hurt or lose control with someone else. The study also shows more soldiers are afraid in Iraq now than at any other point of the occupation of Iraq. A Spanish judge has ordered the arrest and extradition of three U.S. soldiers connected to the killing of Spanish TV cameraman Jose Coso in Iraq. The judge said the action was needed because the U.S. had provided, quote, no judicial cooperation in trying to resolve the death. We'll have more on this in just a few minutes. A 33-year-old Irish correspondent for the Guardian newspaper has been kidnapped in Baghdad. Rory Carroll was apprehended Wednesday by masked gunmen after interviewing a victim of Saddam Hussein's regime. The newspaper's editor, Alan Rusbridger, said, quote, "We urge those holding him to release him swiftly for the sake of his family and for the sake of anyone who believes the world needs to be kept fully informed about events in Iraq today." This news on Afghanistan. An Australian TV program has aired footage of U.S. soldiers burning the bodies of two dead Taliban fighters. The program also aired footage of a U.S. Army PSYOPs unit caught on tape broadcasting news of the burning to local residents. The message read, quote, "You allowed your fighters to be laid down facing west and burnt. You are too scared to retrieve their bodies. This just proves you are the ladyboys we always believe you to be. You attack and run like women. You call yourself Taliban, but you are a disgrace to the Muslim religion, and you bring shame upon your family. Come and fight like men instead of the cowardly dogs you are," the statement said. On Wednesday, the Pentagon announced it would investigate the incident. Meanwhile, at Guantanamo Bay, detainees are accusing guards and medical officials of mistreating prisoners taking part in a camp-wide hunger strike. Detainees said large feeding tubes were forcibly shoved up their noses and down into their stomachs, with guards using the same tubes from one patient to another. The forced feedings reportedly resulted in prisoners vomiting up substantial amounts of blood. The detainees say no sedatives were provided during these procedures, which they allege took place in front of U.S. physicians, including the head of the prison hospital. The accusations were made to New York-based attorney Julia Tarver of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Tarver says one client told her, quote, "Now, after 4 years in captivity, life and death are the same." Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says the Bush administration will not rule out the use of force against Syria. Appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday, Rice said, quote, "I'm not going to get into what the president's options might be. I don't think the president ever takes any of his options off the table concerning anything to do with military force," she said. Rice also ruled out setting a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is in Washington today for a meeting with President Bush at the White House. Abbas is expected to ask Bush to pressure the Israeli government to ease restrictions on Palestinian movement and to freeze settlement activity in the West Bank. Meanwhile, Bush is expected to urge Abbas to ban members of Hamas from running in upcoming elections unless they disarm and renounce violence. On Capitol Hill, the Senate rejected a pair of proposals Wednesday to increase the federal minimum wage for the first time since 1997. Senator Ted Kennedy had proposed raising the wage from $5.15 an hour to $6.25. Kennedy said a single parent with two children working a minimum wage job would earn less than $11,000 a year, $4,500 below the poverty line. A Texas state court has issued an arrest warrant for Tom DeLay. This comes 2 weeks after two separate grand juries indicted DeLay on conspiracy and money laundering charges. DeLay has temporarily stepped down as House Majority Leader. He will now be required to appear in Texas for booking and possibly be fingerprinted and photographed. And finally, the U.S. National Hurricane Center is warning Wilma has become a potentially catastrophic hurricane. At one point on Wednesday, Wilma became the strongest Atlantic Ocean hurricane on record. It's since been downgraded to a Category 4 storm. A mandatory evacuation order is in effect in the Florida Keys, where the storm is expected to hit Saturday and Sunday. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. A Spanish court has issued international arrest warrants for three U.S. soldiers connected to the killing of Spanish TV cameraman José Couso in Iraq. On April 8, 2003, the U.S. military opened fire on the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad, killing two journalists, Taras Protskiuk, a Reuters cameraman from Ukraine, and Couso, who worked for the Spanish TV network Telecinco. On Wednesday, the Spanish judge Santiago Pedras issued arrest warrants for Lieutenant Colonel Philip DeCamp, Captain Philip Wolford, and Sergeant Sean Gibson, all of the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division. The judge also requested the soldiers to be extradited to Spain. The soldiers have not been formally indicted, but they were brought to trial. If brought to trial, they could face jail sentences of up to 20 years for murder and crimes against the international community. Under Spanish law, a crime committed against a Spaniard abroad can be prosecuted in Spain if it is not investigated in the country where it is committed. In a statement issued to Democracy Now!, Army spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Barry Venable defended the actions of the American troops in Iraq. He said, quote, U.S. Central Command fully investigated the incident and determined that the U.S. service members acted appropriately during that combat action. Venable also said the Pentagon has, quote, cooperated previously with the Spanish government, including by providing information concerning the incident and resulting investigation. But Spanish officials disagree. The arrest warrant said the U.S. had provided, quote, no judicial cooperation in trying to resolve the death. After the judge issued the arrest warrants, Jose Coso's brother, Javier, held a press conference in Madrid.
We were recognizing the institutional work. We asked for diplomatic explanations and protections to the family. But right now, they have to face the Spanish justice. What we are going to urge the U.S. government to do is to begin the process for the extradition as soon as possible. This is a crime against the international community and a crime of war. Therefore, in order to be fully satisfied, we're going to pursue that the request for the U.S. soldiers accused of the killing of Jose Couso to be extradited.
Javier Couso, the brother of slain journalist Jose Couso, speaking to reporters in Madrid on Wednesday. He and his mother, Maribel Permuy Lopez, were in Washington, D.C. last month for the anti-war march. I caught up with Maribel at the rally. This is some of what she had to say.
Yo he venido a Washington para denunciar el asesinato de mi hijo en el Hotel Palestina en Baghdad el 8 de abril del 2003.
I have come to Washington to denounce the murder of my son at the Palestine Hotel during the invasion of Iraq on April 8, 2003.
We turn now to the documentary Hotel Palestine, Killing the Witness. It's produced by Jose Couso's network, Telecinco, broadcast on Spanish television. It includes interviews with numerous journalists who were inside the Palestine Hotel, the AP reporter embedded with U.S. forces at the time of the attack, as well as two of the soldiers named in the warrants. This is an excerpt.
Sergeant John Gibson commands one of the tanks that on April 8th would take positions on the Al-Umariya Bridge. He would be the one to fire on the Palestine Hotel. His tank carries the flag of Captain Walford's company. One of his soldiers has no problem in showing it, a skull with two crossed swords. On the left, their nickname, the Assassins. Days after the attack, Gibson agrees to talk to a team from Belgian public television.
It was easy to find them, but difficult to convince them. And the argument I used was, if this goes to court and the affair gets complicated, the most probable result is that the chiefs of staff will lay the blame on you.
I was receiving artillery rounds up there in front of my tank, beside my tank, up under my tank. They were shooting up under my tank with RPGs on the bridge. You go over to the bridge right now, you will see holes up under the bridge where my tank was sitting.
And at one point, he stops the interview.
Want to go look at my tank? You see the shots on my tank? Come on, let's take a look at that. Come on.
Wait. And tells me, I'll show you my tank, how we were attacked. He takes me all around the tank and shows me the holes from all kinds of artillery. At that point of the interview, he was almost angry at having to explain the battle on the bridge to me.
Weeks later, on the bridge, we still find evidence of the battle, although not as much as Gibson asserted. The damaged bridge railing, the impact of rocket-propelled grenades. Other traces reveal the tank's decisive response to attack. Enough to make a hole in this lamppost when they fire on the Ministry of Telecommunications. On April 8th, cameras at the Palestine Hotel film how one of the tanks located behind the bridge is hit. But above all, they see the armored tanks reply to fire with their full power, again and again, and always straight at this building, the Ministry of Youth. That is where the Fedayeen have taken up positions. From a nearby building, an old janitor soon watches them flee.
They all ran away. There was no one left. The ministry was empty. But before that, there was major resistance.
From the Palestine Hotel, journalists can see the bridge, but not the areas from which the tanks are fired upon. The U.S. troops fire continuously on the other side of the river. They are being attacked from an area to the left of the bridge and from the Ministry of Youth, 1,500 meters away from the hotel. If, according to the official explanation, they were being attacked from the Palestine Hotel, why did they only fire a single round in that direction throughout the entire morning? At this point, the official version evolves to include the spotter theory.
It was at that point that Captain Wolford's men had captured an Iraqi prisoner who had a radio. They were monitoring, they had an Arab linguist, an Arab American, listening to the radio, listening to a forward, what they call a forward observer, someone calling in the mortar fire and directing the infantrymen in their attack against Captain Wolford's forces.
Then I went to scan higher. I started going by the floors. I seen no one. Until I get to the upper third floor, I see somebody up there with a pair of big binoculars, and I see them pointing.
All war correspondents carry binoculars for just that kind of thing. To spot a tank 2 kilometers away, and to tell the cameraman that there's a tank over there.
It was simply ridiculous that they should think that tank position coordinates were actually being given from the hotel. You could see the tanks from just about anywhere in the city.
Did Gibson see a journalist with binoculars and think he was an enemy spotter? It could be an excuse, but surprisingly, the sergeant goes on to assert that there were no journalists on the balconies.
We didn't see it was a camera?
There was no camera. I seen binoculars.
A camera on the balconies. Binoculars?
This one? Negative. A person will stand like this with 2 hands in front of their eyes with just a camera, okay? I seen 2 lenses with their hands up holding it. It looked like binoculars to me.
Sean Gibson, one of the 3 soldiers named in the international arrest warrant issued by the Spanish judge Wednesday. That's an excerpt of the documentary Hotel Palestine, Killing the Witness, produced by Jose Coso's network, Telecinco. This is another clip that includes Gibson as well as Lieutenant Colonel Philip DeCamp, another of the soldiers named in the arrest warrants.
Fired.
Gibson swings his cannon toward the hotel and requests Captain Walford's permission to fire, but he still hesitates.
And I still hesitated. You hear me? I hesitated.
I know.
Okay? And I took my time and I called it up to ensure what I seen. And it was clarified with another set of eyes.
The decision was not taken in the heat of battle. 10 minutes go by until Gibson receives the order to open fire.
Une violente déflagration ébranle l'hôtel.
We did not know that they had reporters in the Palestine Hotel. If we would have known that, we would not have fired around over there. I don't even know if that information was given to the U.S. Army. I do not know that, okay? If it was, it didn't get down to my level.
What Colonel Perkins and Colonel DeCamp have told me is that they did not have any information about the Palestine Hotel or the location of Western journalists prior to coming into Baghdad on April 7th.
When Colin Powell visits Spain on May 2nd, he confirms what everyone had assumed. The military command was perfectly aware that the journalists were based at the Palestine Hotel.
We knew about the hotel. We knew that it was a hotel where journalists were located and others. And it is for that reason it was not attacked during any phase of the aerial campaign.
The generals monitoring the fighting from their headquarters in Qatar soon watched the incident broadcast worldwide on television and call Baghdad demanding an explanation.
That image had gone out on satellite television, and their senior commanders at the 2- and 3-star general level messaged them and said, "What are you doing shooting the Palestine Hotel?"
Tomlinson overhears radio communications discussing the incident. Lieutenant Colonel DeCamp is informed of the attack by his superiors and shouts over the radio,
"Who just shot the Palestinian hotel?"
Tomlinson hears how DeCamp, clearly upset, asks Walford,
"Did you just shoot the Palestinian hotel?"
The question, and the way he asked the question was a little misleading. If you When he asked Captain Wolford, did you shoot the Palestine Hotel, he assumed knowledge that Captain Wolford didn't have.
I wish it would have never happened, but it has happened. And I prayed about it and asked God for his forgiveness. And my sincere apologies and grievances to their families. It was not done intentionally.
There was the sense throughout the chain of command, from Perkins to DeCamp to Wolford, all the way down to Sergeant Gibson, that they had done something very bad. That they, I can tell you that Captain Wolford was visibly upset when I saw him 2 hours later. He was very upset about it. Sergeant Gibson is very upset about it. Colonel DeCamp obviously was very angry. He was upset.
Spanish journalists are not as understanding as Tomlinson about the military officer's behavior. The three attacks on journalists on April 8th lead them to think that U.S. forces did not want witnesses.
What's my opinion? My opinion is that there was a deliberate intent to fire on the journalists' hotel.
An excerpt of the documentary Hotel Palestine, Killing the Witness. It's produced by José Cosa's network, Telecinco, and broadcast on Spanish television. José Cosa is the Spanish cameraman who, along with Reuters cameraman Taras Prostyuk, was killed when the U.S. military shelled the hotel on April 8, 2003. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we broadcast on over 375 stations around the country on Pacifica, NPR, and low-power FM stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, and also on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we are podcasting at democracynow.org with headlines and Spanish in transcript as well as audio. Juan?
Well, Saddam Hussein's trial has begun in Baghdad with the former Iraqi leader defiantly questioning the validity of the court before pleading not guilty for crimes against humanity. He and seven associates all pleaded not guilty to charges of ordering and killing 143 Shia men in 1982 in the village of Dujail. If convicted, they could face the death penalty. Saddam Hussein entered the courtroom wearing a dark jacket over an open-necked shirt and carrying a copy of the Quran. He refused to identify himself and questioned the validity of the proceedings. He told the judges, quote, "I preserve my constitutional rights as the president of Iraq. I do not recognize the body that has authorized you, and I don't recognize this aggression. What is based on injustice is unjust. I do not respond to this so-called court with all due respect." Later, as the trial adjourned, he was involved in what appeared to be a scuffle with the guards who wanted to grab his arms to escort him out. The case is being heard in a specially built courtroom in the heavily fortified green zone in the Iraqi capital. The courtroom is ringed with 10-foot-high blast walls and U.S. and Iraqi troops.
Saddam Hussein's co-accused include his half-brother, Barzan Ibrahim al-Tikriti, who was his intelligence chief and former vice president, Taha Yassin Ramadan. The trial is being presided over by five judges. It had been suggested that their identities and backgrounds would be kept secret for their own protection. But the lead judge has now been named as Riskar Mohammed Amin, an ethnic Kurd. While a small number of observers and journalists were allowed in the courtroom, the public was excluded. The trial was broadcast on satellite stations around the world with a 20-minute delay. The case is the first of many expected to be brought against the 68-year-old Saddam Hussein. It concerns the rounding up and execution of 143 men in Dujail, a Shia village north of Baghdad, following an attempt there on Saddam Hussein's life. Iraqi mother Ahmed is one of those who may give evidence in the trial. She remembered what happened in 1982.
1 week after the assassination attempt, they came and rounded us and detained all of us, the children and the elderly and even my sister-in-law, who was 2 months pregnant then. They took us to the intelligence department first, where they tortured us, and after that they moved us to Abu Ghraib prison. And they kept us there for several months after separating us from our brother. We don't know where they were. They kept the women separately. They imprisoned us. They imprisoned my mother, a 70-year-old blind woman, with us, and my sister, and my stepmother, too. All of us. Even my two little brothers. They took our family and imprisoned us all. They executed my 7 brothers, and I caught asthma while in prison. I want to see justice done for my 7 brothers, and that means having Saddam executed 7 times over. I support the death penalty.
Iraqi mother Ahmed, the charge against Saddam Hussein and his associates carries the death penalty, though they've the right to appeal if they're found guilty. Prosecution lawyers are also expected to bring charges concerning the gassing of 5,000 people in the Kurdish village of Halabja in March 1988 and the suppression of a Shia revolt following the first Gulf War. Iran said Tuesday it had asked the court to charge the former Iraqi leader over the use of chemical weapons in the Iran-Iraq War. And just over three hours, the trial was adjourned until November 28th. Saddam Hussein's defense team had said they wanted a postponement to prepare their case, but Reuters quoted the chief judge as saying the main reason was witnesses had not shown up. Khalil al-Dulaimi, Saddam's chief lawyer, told the German newspaper Der Spiegel earlier this week, quote, "The entire proceeding is a farce. Nothing's occurring according to procedure. We did not receive any official documents until September 25th. This is a dramatic violation of Iraqi laws," he said. Human rights groups, too, have expressed concern. Both Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have questioned the impartiality and independence of the court. The U.S. drew up the original statutes of the special tribunal and is partly funding it. We're joined now by Larry Everest, author of the book Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, writes frequently for the Revolutionary Worker newspaper. Your response to the trial of Saddam Hussein?
I think the thing that strikes me most is the enormous hypocrisy on many different levels of the United States government. Saddam Hussein has been accused of killing 300,000 Iraqis, horrible crimes. The fact of the matter is that the United States was directly complicit in his worst crimes, including encouraging him to invade Iran, supplying and facilitating his use of chemical weapons, directly calibrating chemical attacks during the 1980s. In fact, 1 month before the Dujail massacre, Ronald Reagan signed a secret finding urging the United States to help prevent an Iraqi loss. The other thing that strikes me is, in terms of the incredible hypocrisy of this, is the fact that while the United States is accusing Saddam of crimes against humanity, it is committing crimes against humanity right now as we speak in Iraq. This week, 70 people, including many civilians, were killed in what can only be described as a revenge attack and collective punishment in the city of Ramadi. We have new reports of torture that were brought that have been brought out, and which the soldiers are saying are going on across Iraq, that make Abu Ghraib pale in comparison, people's feet being smashed with axes and so on. And I heard this testimony firsthand in Istanbul. What stands out to me is that it's the Bush administration that should be brought to trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity. And
our understanding is that you are organizing now a commission of inquiry here in the United States on the war?
That's correct, Juan. This Friday in Manhattan at 6 o'clock at the Manhattan Center, we're opening our first session with a special message from Howard Zinn, addresses by Mark Raskin and Michael Ratner of the Center. We'll have presentations by Barbara Olshansky, testimony from people like Dennis Halliday. We're going to be inquiring into Bush crimes on the war, on torture, on the devastation of the global environment, and on its response to the AIDS pandemic. And if people want to give us find out much more, I urge them to go to our website, www.bushcommission.org. And we're also...
Larry, I want to thank you. I've got to cut you off here, but I want to thank you for being with us. We'll make links on our website at democracynow.org. Larry Everest, author of Oil, Power, and Empire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we turn now to continue with the issue of Iraq, the media and the war, with veteran Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk. During 30 years that he's reported on the Middle East, he's covered every major event in the region, from the Algerian war to the Iranian revolution, from the American hostage crisis in Beirut to the Iran-Iraq war, from the Russian invasion of Afghanistan to Israel's invasion of Lebanon, from the Gulf War to the invasion and ongoing occupation of Iraq. I spoke with Robert Fisk in Santa Fe, New Mexico last month, an event sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. He was in a studio in Toronto, Canada, brought in by satellite into the packed Lensic Theater on a huge screen. Fisk, one of the first people to talk about a quagmire in Iraq. I asked him his assessment of the current situation there and what needs to be done.
3 days after the Americans came to Baghdad, I said the real story is about to begin, and that is the story of the war against American occupation. And a lot of my colleagues thought that was a very, very funny. They hooted at me with laughter over it, though not anymore. Look, apart from the Kurdistan area, Iraq is now in a state of total anarchy and chaos. No roads are safe outside Baghdad. Much of Baghdad is in insurgent hands. Only the little green zones, the armored hotel areas, where the Westerners live and swim and in some cases don't even leave their rooms, and that, alas, applies to many journalists. Only here are people allowed to have the illusion that things are getting better, things are improving. Outside in the streets, where some journalists still go, including, for example, my colleague Patrick Coben of The Independent and myself and The Guardian newspaper, not most Americans, though one or two. Out in the streets, where few of us go, it is hell on earth. I managed to get a couple of weeks ago to the mortuary in the city of Baghdad, as I've often gone in the past, counting the bodies at midday and midsummer out in the heat. There were 26 by midday, 9 had arrived by 9 in the morning. And I managed to get the official figures for July for the total number of violent deaths in Baghdad alone. And the figure was 1,100 violent deaths, men, women and children. Shot, butchered, knifed, executed, death squad killings. A figure which, of course, is not given out by the Iraqi Health Ministry and is certainly not given out by the occupation authorities. We now have a situation in Iraq where there is a full-scale insurgency by both Shiites and Sunnis against Western forces. Once an insurgency of that kind starts in a Muslim country, it is impossible to quench it. Sorry, you guys, can we put the book back? Let's start again. We got it wrong at one point. You can't do that. You can't do that. I was discussing with an Iraqi friend 3 weeks ago in Baghdad what he thought the answer was, and he said, there is no answer. You've got to go. You've got to go. And I wrote at the time that I thought there was a terrible equation in Iraq. And it goes like this. The Americans must leave. And the Americans will leave. But the Americans can't leave. And that's the equation that turns sand into blood. Once you become an occupying power, you take upon responsibilities for the civilians, which we have not done, but you also have responsibility to yourself. You have to keep justifying over and over and over again to your own populations. You were right to do it. Okay, there were no weapons of mass destruction, but we got rid of Saddam. Okay, we haven't got the electricity working yet, but there is a constitution. Well, we hope there'll be a constitution, and we did have some elections, didn't we? Do you remember them in January? And all the time, the people die in ever greater numbers. Remember that figure for July, 1,100. That's just Baghdad. What does that mean for the whole country? 5,000 dead in July? What does that mean in a whole of Iraq in a year? 5 12s are? You see the problem? We're talking of 50, 60,000 dead a year now. And the worst figure we've heard is 100,000 since 2003. And yet still we don't get statistics. When individual journalists have to go to hospital mortuaries and count the bloated corpses on the floor, you know you've got problems. And I tell you, I the last time I was in Baghdad, I began to ask myself whether the dangers, and I've never done this on any other war except for the Algerian war, which was very similar in many ways, questioning whether the dangers of covering Iraq are any longer worth the story. I suppose I think they are, but I guess having looked in my face in the mirror occasionally and seen the grey hairs, I wonder if I should keep going there. I probably will, but I'm not sure.
Robert, what about the number of journalists who have died? This weekend there's going to be a major anti-war protest in Washington on the 24th and all over the country. Two of the people who will be there are the mother and brother of Jose Coso, who is the Spanish cameraman for Telecinco, killed at the Palestine Hotel the day before the U.S. forces pulled down the statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdaus Square.
No, it was the same day. It was the first Armored Division tank on the Jumeirah Bridge. It was an American tank that killed him, absolutely, but it was the same day. Mm.
Now, he is one of scores of people, of journalists, who have died. Most recently, a Reuters photographer killed, his colleague arrested by U.S. forces and held. Another is being held at the Abu Ghraib prison. Dozens of journalists. What about your colleagues in Iraq right now?
The total figure of journalists to have died during and after the 2003 invasion up to date is now 68, the most recent being an Iraqi stringer, again for the New York Times, in Basra, who was found dumped on a waste tip, executed with 3 bullets through the back of his head. I suspect the Iraqi police, quote unquote, killed him, like I suspect the Iraqi police killed the American journalist in Basra. Look, there's no doubt it's becoming the most dangerous story for journalists anywhere ever. If you want to look at the worst period, it would be in Bosnia in 92, when a lot of journalists who'd never been in wars before were sent in to Bosnia and were dying at the rate of dozens a month. And that was primarily, I think, because they were sending very young men whose experience of war was Hollywood, where the hero, of course, always survives. And what is shocking about this is that almost all the journalists who are being killed, almost without exception in Iraq, are experienced, in many cases middle-aged, guys who've been under fire many times before, who know about the lethality of weapons, and whose jobs and lives are simply no longer respected. I've never been in a war like the Iraq War, in which our lives are so endangered, so targeted, by all sides, it sometimes seems. And I'm not sure what we can do about it. The American correspondents, some of them, are guarded by armed Iraqis. The New York Times has a compound with 4 watchtowers and armed Iraqis with NYT, New York Times, on their black T-shirts. NBC lives in a hotel in the Karada district with iron grills. The AP lives in the Palestine Hotel with 2 armored walls. Very rarely do they ever venture out, and never do the American staffers go on the streets. As I say, we still go out with Iraqi friends. We actually go out to lunch in restaurants in Iraq. But I think that's probably because as long as we're with Iraqis and we look at our watch and say, okay, 20 minutes, finish the meal, half an hour, got to be out, you're okay. But it's a calculated risk, and as I said to you, I'm not sure the risks are worth it anymore. Our lives are worth nothing to the insurgents. Our lives appear to be worth virtually nothing to the Americans or the British. I think that when you reach a stage where our lives and our jobs are simply no longer respected, you do have to ask the question, is it worth it anymore? I think it is, because I think Iraq is an appalling tragedy, primarily for Iraqis, of course, who we don't put at the top of our list. We say 1,900 Americans, you know, 93 Brits or whatever it may be, and it's the Iraqis who are doing the suffering and the dying primarily in vast numbers, many of them because they trusted us and took our shilling and wanted to work for the police or wanted to work for construction companies building landing strips for the Americans or fortresses for the Americans. But I think the whole Iraqi story for us as journalists is becoming almost impossible to cover. Certainly, if you have a journalist who lives behind two armoured walls of a hotel who just uses a mobile phone to call British or American diplomats or behind another big concrete wall, you might as well live in County Mayo, Ireland, or Santa Fe, New Mexico. There's no point in being there. And, for example, the last trip I made outside Baghdad, it took me 2 weeks to arrange it to go down to Najaf. And it was the most fearful trip. I drove the road with three Iraqi friends, one of them a Shiite prelate, a clergyman, a religious man. All the checkpoints of the Iraqi army had been abandoned. This just after George Bush says the Iraqi army is in the field, right? There were upturned Iraqi police cars, burned out American vehicles. I didn't see a member of the security forces until I reached the outskirts of Najaf, about 80 miles from Iraq. The whole of the countryside outside Baghdad is under the control. It is now the property of the armed insurgents, both Sunni and Shia. This we are not being told. This President Bush will not acknowledge. This our own dear Mr. Blair will not acknowledge. And that is part of the tragedy. And it seems now to be part of our life that New Orleans flooding is not real until it's real. That the collapse of Iraq is not real until it's real. With such poor television coverage, although we did get good pictures, I noticed, of the British soldiers on fire, for heaven's sakes, on their warrior armoured vehicles. I don't know if it's possible to explain what is happening in Iraq anymore. Most journalists, Western journalists, are now relying upon Iraqi stringers, Iraqi correspondents, to risk their necks on the streets. And they are risking their necks, and they are dying for it, to bring in the news. But there are no, by and large, there are no Western eyes, independently, for journalists on the streets, unarmed. My newspaper does not have protection. We do not carry weapons. But my goodness, as I say, I don't know how long we can continue doing this. Each time Patrick and I go to Iraq, it's a little bit worse. And when we look back at what it was like a year ago, which was considered appalling, we're amazed at how free we were, how easily we went grocery shopping. I still go grocery shopping for 6 minutes only, grab the bread, push my way to the front of the queue, pay out. You learn a lot. I went out to my favorite restaurant, the Ramayya, the other day to find it was no longer the Ramayya. It was now given an Islamic name and had a green neon sign. And when I went inside, the menu was no longer in English, French, and Arabic. It was only in Arabic. No more bottles of Lebanese red wine for Bob of Arabia, of course. It had been totally Islamicized. And you need to get out to see this and understand it. But the problem is most of our colleagues are not permitted even by their head offices to do that.
Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk of Britain's Independent newspaper. We'll be back with him in a minute. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we return to the interview with Robert Fisk. I spoke to him at the Lensic Theater in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He was in Toronto, Canada.
We've just returned from New Orleans, and something that is most stunning about what has happened with the media, aside from the horror that has taken place, is that because the National Guard were in Iraq, because President Bush did not get the resources there immediately, there were no troops for the reporters to embed with. And so what happened is you had reporters, well, where you often are, with the victims, in the street, reporting the facts on the ground, like we have never seen a reporter with a body that floats by behind them. And then when government officials say this isn't true, the reporters actually challenge the government officials because they are experiencing this themselves. One of the first things President Bush did when he started getting involved was say that the bodies of corpses, the corpses were not to be photographed. I think what has turned this country around right now is that people have truly seen the real images of New Orleans in a way that we have not seen in Iraq. Can you talk about the whole embedding process and the control of the media?
It's not about embedding. It's not about embedding, Amy. It's about television's refusal to show the truth of war. Let me give you an example. In 1991, I was driving up the main road towards Basra, the so-called Highway of Death, further up, with a crew from ITV, a British commercial channel. And we stopped at a place where there were large numbers of Iraqi soldiers dead in the desert. And hordes of desert dogs had appeared. And they were ripping the soldiers to pieces and eating them, dragging off an arm here with its hand cruelly going along through the desert, eating through stomachs, gnawing away at cheekbones of dead soldiers. The ITV crew got out and started filming. I said, what are you filming this for? You'll never get it on air. He said, no, it's just for the archives. And this, you see, was the problem. The war was over then. We're talking about the 1991 Gulf War, the liberation of Kuwait, when journalists had been put in pools, which was then the equivalent of embedding. And they chafed that they wanted to report real war and weren't being allowed to. They were being censored. But when the war had ended, and they were allowed to drive up the highway and film anything they wanted, they censored themselves. Far too sensitive. Can't see this sort of thing at breakfast. And what about the children? And in London and in Washington and New York and everywhere else, Paris, the television directors and the editors sit and say, oh, we can't show that scene. Impossible. Many of the worst pictures taken in the invasion of Iraq in 2003. A man holding a kid out like a piece of a pancake. A beautiful girl in the arms of a man. We had to lop off here because we didn't want to see the bones of the foot sticking out. She was dead, wounded in many captions. Never saw the light of day. They couldn't be shown. They could, but they were not. Because sensitivities mustn't show this sort of breakfast time. It's irresponsible to show the dead like this. It's disrespectful. I tell you, if you saw what I saw when I go to wars, when I'm on the front line, with or without soldiers, or with civilians, or wounded, or in hospitals, if you saw what I saw, you would never, ever dream of supporting a war again, ever in your life. It's a remarkable thing that the cinema, the commercial cinema, feature films, can now show the bloodiest, goriest scenes, which are quite similar to what we see in real life. Saving Private Ryan, the guts spilling out. And yet, real war cannot be shown without censoring pictures, which in many cases are exactly the same as what you see when you go to the cinema or when you watch a movie, a war movie on television. It's remarkable. And only when you're there do you realize, and I have an editor in London who shakes his head in disbelief and boredom when I say this to him over and over again, if you go to a war, you realize that it is not primarily about victory or defeat. It is about death and the infliction of death and suffering on as large a scale as you can make it. It is about the total failure of the human spirit. But we don't show that because we don't want to. And in this sense, journalists, television reporting, television cameras are lethal. They collude with governments to allow you to have more wars, because if they showed you the truth, you wouldn't allow any more wars.
Robert Fisk, two questions. One is, why do you think President Bush has done this? And what do you think, since you write in your book that's just about to come out, The Great War for Civilization, about the increasing call of your readers, questions, outcry, what can we do? Why do you think he's done this? What do you think he wants to accomplish now? And what do you think people can do?
Look, what Bush did in 2003 and what our own Lord Blair of Kutalamara, as I call him, did, our Prime Minister, whom we deeply love, what they both did is they made a terrible mistake, which history should have taught them not to make. They went to war for ideological reasons. They dressed it up in military reasons, weapons of mass destruction, saving the poor Shiites or the poor Sunnis or the poor Kurds or whatever you like, destruction of Saddam Hussein, giving democracy to the Middle East. There'll be some more come up soon before we tell the Iraqis that they're ungrateful and they should be more grateful than they are. We're already beginning to tell them in the letters columns, I noticed. But they went to war for ideological reasons. If you do that, you will always fail. You see, everything goes wrong in a war based on ideology, whether it be right-wing Christian ideology, fundamentalist ideology, whether it be the ideology of American Western democracy has to supplant the dictatorships of the Middle East. I won't go into that because we'll all fall asleep. But what happens is that everything about your military purpose gets perverted. For example, look at American intelligence. It's hopeless in Iraq, absolutely hopeless. All they do is arrest the wrong people. People get beaten up. People get tortured. Yes, they do, by the way. And yet America has this extraordinary intelligence-gathering apparatus, massive supercomputers sucking in telephone calls, millions of them, from all over the Middle East, translators going through page after page, not fast enough, as we know, on September before September 11th, 2001, but doing it. And they amass this huge volume after volume of intelligence of what's going on in the Middle East. Now, if you're able to understand injustice, which is what the Middle East is partly and principally about, you could make sense of it. But if you're going to go ideologically at this intelligence and try to make it fit what you believe or what you want to believe, then the whole CIA is eliminated. It doesn't matter anymore. It's worthless. And that's why, for example, the background, the foundation of the Iraq War is built on sand. Because it was an ideological war. It wasn't based on what do Iraqis want, what would really happen. It was also based on oil, I know that, because if the chief export of Iraq was asparagus, we wouldn't be there, would we? But when you base a war on ideology, that's what happens. You lose. And when you lie about the basis of it, you lose. And the war in Iraq has been lost already. It's only prison journalism or hotel journalism and the lies of the State Department and the Pentagon and the White House and the Downing Street and the Defense Ministry in London and so on that keep this spin rolling. At some point, there's going to be an explosion, the like of which will be inexplicable by those in power. I don't know what it's going to be, but it will come. How do we deal with it? I don't know. You see, those readers who write to me, and still do, literally, I've got a bunch of mail outside this studio in my bag. What can we do? There seems to have been a complete breakdown in Britain between the electors and the elected. One of the reasons, of course, is that the Tory party in Britain supported the Labour Party, and it's the press who've become the opposition. You have a bigger problem in the United States in that, as I understand it, well, I'll quote actually a US Marine who said to me in San Diego a few months ago, our problem is we have this kind of false democracy. He said, we go and vote for our senators or congressmen for what they say they'll give us, and then they go and say something completely different. And I think you have a big problem with lobby groups. I don't just mean the Israeli lobby, I mean the gun lobby and so on. I think you have a major problem with lobby groups in Washington. And every president comes along saying he's going to clean that out, but he never does. Actually, Bush didn't say that, not George W. anyway. But I think you have a much bigger problem in the United States where on issues like the Middle East, for example, your voice is simply not heard unless it is pro-Israeli, pro-American policy in the Middle East, etc., up on the Hill. I mean, you'll get a few brave souls, Paul Finley, and look what happened to him. But basically, you won't get represented on these critical issues. And American policy in the Middle East is the critical issue in all our lives at the moment. I go at much greater length into this in my new book, at the issue of why after September 11, 2001. I remember having this terrible argument with that Boston professor, Dershowitz, who called me a dangerous man. He's anti-American, it's the same as being anti-Semitic, which is rubbish, of course. I'm neither. But anyone who asked the question, why did it happen, was seen as being unpatriotic, potential enemy, therefore anti-American, anti-people, anti-democracy. Because, of course, to ask the question why, we have to say, well, hold on a second, the 19 hijackers came from the Arabs. They came from the Middle East. Is there a problem out there? And we can't go into that. And it's strange because, you know, if you have a crime in Santa Fe, the cops come along and the first thing they do is look for the motive. But when you have an international crime against humanity on the scale of September 11th, 2001, the one thing you're not allowed to do is look for the motive for the crime. And I think that, by and large, for many months, Americans were prevented from looking for the motive. And by the time they could look for the motive, oh, we were bombing Afghanistan and saying there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and then defeating Saddam Hussein, and so it goes on and on. And it seems somehow that modern-day politicians, with, in many cases, the help, I'm afraid, of journalists, are able to continue to bamboozle people. Oh, we'll explain it tomorrow. Oh, that's too secret to tell you. Senior intelligence officials insist. Look at the New York Times' first paragraphs over and over again. According to American intelligence officials, American officials say. I think sometimes the New York Times should be called American officials say. Just look at it tomorrow or the day after. Or the LA Times or the San Francisco Chronicle. It's not much of a paper anymore, unfortunately, but the Washington Post. It's almost as if, you know, the cozy relationship between American journalists and power is very dangerous. You want to look and see what that relationship is like, the osmotic, you know, the host and the parasite together. You only have to look at a White House press conference. Mr. President? Yes, Bob. Yes, John. Yes, Nancy. That's the relationship. And journalists like to be close to power. And they know that if they want to be close to power, they mustn't challenge power. And that goes back to the Amira Haas definition of journalism, which I am a total devotee of. You must challenge power all the time, all the time, all the time. Even if the politicians and the prime minister, even if your readers hate you, you must challenge power. And that includes bin Laden power.
Robert Fisk, we are out of time, but I just have a quick question, perhaps the biggest
to ask. Thank goodness, Amy.
And that is, you've covered the Israeli invasions of Lebanon, the Iranian Revolution, the Iran-Iraq War, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Gulf War, wars in Algeria, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Enough.
What gives you hope?
Yeah.
What gives you hope?
Nothing. I'm sorry, nothing. I'm sorry. Nothing at the moment. Ordinary people, I guess. Ordinary people who speak out. People in the Arab world as well. But in terms of governments, nothing much. I may be wrong. I may be too much of a pessimist because I've seen too much.
Robert Fisk, author of The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East, reports for the Independent newspaper for 30 years based in the Middle East. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shruf Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper. Special thanks to Gretchen Begley. Our website to get a copy of today's show is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. You can go to our website for transcript and tape. Thanks for joining us.